I want to welcome everyone here this morning to the Second Court of Appeals. We've got two cases that will be argued at 9 o'clock, followed by another one that will be argued at 10:30. As I understand it, all attorneys have checked in for all parties. So if the clerk of the court would please, before we get started, I'd like to introduce my panel. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr. And to my left is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Sutterth. The clerk, please call the first case.
We will now call Peterson, Golan, and Bellani and for holding. And may it please the court, Mr. Stephen Sanfilippo to argue for the appellant, Mr. Jason Nash to argue for the appellant.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. Steve Sanfilippo for Appellant Peterson, Goldman, and Villani, or PGV. This is the third appeal related to PGV's attempts to collect on a guarantee executed by Ancor Holdings, LLC. Shortly after the guarantee was signed, Ancor LLC merged into Ancor Holdings LLC and Ancor Holdings LP. I'll shorten it to LLC and LP for clarity. In the first appeal, the Fifth Court of Appeals affirmed a judgment confirming an arbitration award in favor of PGV and against Ancor LLC for breach of the guarantee agreement. But the Dallas Court also affirmed the trial court's refusal to modify the judgment to name Ancor LP as a judgment debtor as a result of the merger. While that appeal was pending, the PGV filed a second lawsuit against Ancor Holdings LP in Dallas. That case was subsequently transferred to Tarrant County and is the case that brings us before the court. The trial court originally granted summary judgment on all of PGV's claims based upon Ancor Holdings LP's affirmative defenses, and the appeal on docket equalization purposes was sent to the Eighth Court of Appeals. The Eighth Court reversed that judgment, finding that res judicata did not apply, or that at least it hadn't been established, that Ancor was stopped from asserting a statute of limitations defense, but it did affirm the summary judgment as to the tort claim. So it sent the case back on the contract-based claims. When the case was remanded back on the contract-based claims, the trial court once again granted summary judgment on those claims based upon the affirmative defense of res judicata. It also denied two summary judgments that PGV had filed, and that brings us to the appeal that is currently before the court.
Counsel, let me ask you, before the arbitration award was entered, did your client have actual or constructive knowledge of the merger of the LLC into the LP?
They did not have actual knowledge. Did they have constructive knowledge? The filings had been on file with the court. I haven't seen a case that says, you know, the merger was a breach of the guarantee agreement. Under the terms of the guarantee agreement, they could not merge without Bank of America's permission. I haven't seen a case that holds that a bank is subject to constructive notice that a party has breached a guarantee agreement in a scenario like this. In fact, I haven't seen a case involving a scenario.
Well, do you agree with the appellee that Bank of America didn't seem to think that the guarantee had been triggered?
No, I would not agree with that, Your Honor. In fact, I would tell you that fails for several reasons. Number one, I'm not necessarily sure that what Bank of America thought about whether or not it triggered mattered. Whether it triggered is a matter of contract instruction or construction. And I will tell you, first of all, Ancor LLC made the same argument to the arbitrator, and it was rejected. The argument was based upon a single email, and that email also recognized that there could be other factors that could cause the guarantee to trigger. I will tell you there's at least three other factors that caused that guarantee to trigger. One of them was the bankruptcy trustee's preference claim, which affected the bank's lien status. One of them was the filing of the bankruptcy petition alone, which the courts of appeals found was, I think it was the Dallas Court of Appeals that found that was triggered the guarantee. And there was a third factor, which was in and of itself the merger. So we would not agree that, in fact, Bank of America had determined that the guarantee didn't trigger. And in fact, if they had the record, and it is in the record at 1 Clerk's Record 450, is a demand letter sent by Bank of America on July 7th, 2000, talking about Ancor's liability under the guarantee. And in fact, if they believed that the guarantee hadn't triggered, they would have had no reason to pursue that. And they pursued it. And therefore, we would say that, you know, again, whether it matters or not, I don't think it does. It's a matter of contract construction. But to the extent it does matter, I don't think it's an issue that it triggered.
I've got a question.
Yes, ma'am.
When you attempted, or your client attempted to litigate or to add LC as a judgment debtor, didn't you attempt then to litigate the merger issue? And what I'm talking about is the liability for the debt because of the merger, and therefore invoked res judicata as to the merger, the liability for debt under the merger.
I don't believe we did, Your Honor. By the time that we raised the issue, the arbitration itself had been finalized. We were at the point of seeking to confirm the judgment, and the issue that was raised was a misnomer issue, purely as was an issue of whether or not they were the same entity. The Dallas Court of Appeals found, in fact, that they were separate and distinct entities.
I recognize that, but the issue, there's two transactions involved. There's the liability under the guarantee, and then there's the liability under the merger. Okay, and those are two, in my mind, separate transactions. Okay, but you attempted to bring them in as liable under the merger during the court's plenary power, after the arbitration award had already been made. But nevertheless, you attempted to litigate that issue of whether or not LC was liable for that debt. Now, you did use the misnomer theory, but nevertheless, you brought that transaction into the lawsuit. So, didn't that then invoke res judicata?
I don't believe it did. What we argued that.
But you're kind of putting your toe in the water on that.
Well, I mean, we did what we had to do at the time. We realized that the merger had taken place, but we did it from the standpoint of, and I'll tell you, sitting here today looking at those documents, I would tell you that, you know, absent the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion, there's one entity. It's Ancor LP. The LLC ceased to exist. That's why it was brought as a misnomer argument. It wasn't until that the Dallas Court of Appeals found otherwise that leaves us with, okay, now you've got LP and LLC. They're separate and distinct entities.
But once you put your toe in the water, aren't you required to go the whole way, or res judicata is going to bar relitigation of that issue?
I don't know that we are at that late stage in the game, because LP wasn't a party to the case. And that claim, if they're separate entities, right, LLC was the
only... But they're in privity with each other, aren't they?
Are they? I don't know that.
Well,
I would agree that they're necessarily in privity with each other. They argued vehemently when we tried to bring them in that they were so different it would be a due process violation if they were brought in, because they didn't get a chance to craft their own unique
Well, they'd have
defense.
To be in privity for you to collect from them, wouldn't they?
We're collecting because they assumed the debt under the terms of the merger agreement.
Isn't that privity?
I don't know that it's privity for purposes of res judicata.
Oh, you think it's a different standard for res judicata?
The privity is your. Are you so similar that your rights were adequately represented by the previous party? They said they weren't. I think we win on res judicata because the claims weren't litigated and could not have been litigated in that original case for purposes of res judicata, which is a separate element. But we're not conceding on the privity element either. I will grant you that that's probably a closer call. But
did the arbitration award and confirmation of the award essentially make a final judgment that the party, the entity that was directly liable on the guarantee, was the LLC? Is that correct?
Well, it's LP is the successor. LLC was the signatory.
That wasn't my question. My question was the judgment that you obtained through the arbitration was against the LLC.
Yes.
Okay. That's ultimately was affirmed, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Are you if in fact you now were seeking direct liability against the LP, would not that be res judicata with regard to a direct liability theory? In other words, if you sued on the guarantee saying that, in fact, LP was the correct party to sue on the guarantee, as opposed to suing on the judgment under the merger agreement as a third-party beneficiary.
Perhaps if they were the same entity. Perhaps if they were found to be the same entity. As the separate, with the finding that they're separate and distinct entities, there was only one party that could be sued on the guarantee. Ancor LLC is the only entity that executed the guarantee. So until there was, you know, they're the only party that could have breached it. Once it was breached, now you've got a judgment, okay? Who's responsible for paying for the judgment? Under the terms of the merger and assumption agreement, the separate entity, LP, assumed that debt. That's a separate transaction. That's a separate claim from the, we're no longer litigating the claim of liability under the guarantee. That's already been established. Now we're litigating the issue of whether or not the separate entity, LP, is responsible for that judgment. And I mean,
in other words, not as a matter of direct liability, but as a matter of contractual obligation assumption to LLC.
That's exactly correct.
Okay. So how do you make that distinction in your live pleadings at the time of the motion for summary judgment's in question?
I believe.
In other words, do you make any allegation of breach of contract? You make an allegation of breach of contract,
right?
Okay. Do you seek attorney's fees for the breach of contract? What contract is being breached? What contract do you allege is breached?
It would be basically the failure of the guarantee agreement to honor the debt of the guarantee agreement.
Okay. Are you saying it was a breach of the guarantee agreement, or are you saying a breach of the merger agreement?
Well, I would tell you, I think we've got two ways to it. One is a third
party. Well, no, I'm asking you what your pleadings argue as the breach of contract. What contract is being breached in your pleadings?
Off the top of my head, Your Honor, I'm not sure that we were that specific on which contract it was. In all candor, I don't have the pleading in front of me. My suspicion is it may be the guarantee. But I will tell you, we also have an unjust enrichment claim in there. We have a third-party beneficiary route, I think, on the breach of contract claim as well.
So, well, but as a third-party beneficiary, you would have to allege that LP is in breach of its obligation to LLC, whom you are a third-party beneficiary to that contract, and therefore can assert those rights as a judgment creditor of LLC.
In all candor, Your Honor, I can't remember what is in our pleading. I can tell you that those issues weren't raised as part of the summary judgment briefing, and there wasn't summary judgment granted on those claims on that type of basis. I'd like to talk a little bit about the affirmative motion for summary judgment. We hashed this out a little bit on res judicata. That was the sole basis for summary judgment. We've argued law of the case. We've argued privity. Those are all briefed. I will tell you that I think this turns the main element that really is not met is whether or not the claims were based on the same claims as were raised or could have been raised. The Texas Supreme Court has stated that could have been raised element is akin to a compulsory counterclaim. In other words, what is the gist of the complaint? Is the gist of the complaint the same facts and circumstances at issue in both cases? And our argument would be no. The gist of the Dallas case was LLC's liability under the guarantee agreement. The gist of this case is whether LP is responsible for that liability that has now been established as a result of the murder, the merger. So with that, we would submit that the court erred for that reason alone in granting the summary judgment on res judicata because of the fact that that essential element was not met. We'll stand on our briefs on our other grounds. We think privity and we think law of the case gets us there as well, but as a matter of law, this same claims element is not met for res judicata. That pushes us to Ancor PGV's affirmative motion for summary judgment. We negated the res judicata defense for the reason we already talked about. We also negated the latches defense as a matter of law. In order to establish latches, ANCOR had to prove that PGV unreasonably delayed in asserting a right, and ANCOR LP changed its position in good faith and to its detriment because of the delay. We would submit that each of those essential elements was conclusively negated in our motion for summary judgment. First, with the delay, ANCOR relied primarily upon the fact that 8 years had passed between the merger and the time suit was filed. But as the Texas Supreme Court and others have held, the mere lapse of time alone does not establish latches. It has to be an unreasonable delay, and we would submit under the undisputed facts of this case, there was no unreasonable delay as a matter of law. PGV didn't buy the debt until 2003. Yeah, it was March 2003. In April 2003, they sent a demand letter. By February 2004, they filed a lawsuit. They didn't realize, with that, we would, unless the court's going to allow me to continue, I think we would just respectfully request that the judgment be reversed.
Thank you. Response?
May it please the court, counsel. If I may, Your Honors, there were a couple of questions that were asked by Justice Kerr and one question asked by Justice Sutter that I would like to address before I present my points today. The question was, before the arbitration award, was there actual knowledge of the merger or was there constructive knowledge of the merger? I think the record is positively conclusive that there was constructive knowledge of the merger well before the arbitration award. Well,
just based on the Secretary of State filings?
That is correct, Justice Kerr. Well before they filed the original Dallas suit, 4 years before, they were charged with constructive notice. And the law says with constructive notice, you are deemed to have irrebuttable actual knowledge of the matters contained within the public record. But to go further to your question, Justice Kerr, was there actual knowledge? There certainly was as a matter of law, but as a matter of just fact, there was actual knowledge of this merger before the finality of the original judgment in the Dallas suit.
Are you referring to that passage, the testimony that you highlighted in your brief, where the officers talked about which company he worked for? Or was there more than that?
There's more than that. There was a deposition where one of the officers of ANCOR said, before the arbitration award, in his second deposition, which PGB really skips over, he did testify that ANCOR is actually an LP. It's actually called LP.
But he didn't talk about a merger.
Correct. And I'm sorry, Justice Sutter. The knowledge of the merger came when PGB itself raised the issue after the arbitration award was entered, but there were several months before the confirmation hearing. There were several confirmation hearings, as a matter of fact, before Judge Jordan and the 160th in Dallas. It was at those hearings, before that judgment was final, when they argued there is still plenary power of the trial court over that judgment to modify it, to vacate it, to change it. They presented the merger, and they said, Judge, we want to keep our judgment. Don't want it changed. Don't want it vacated. Don't even want it modified. We just want it amended to strike out the name of LLC and put LP in there.
Their position was they needed the substitution of LP because LP had merged with LLC, and LLC didn't exist anymore, and on that basis, they were one and the same entity at the point in time when the lawsuit got filed. They were one and the same entity during the course of the arbitration, and they were one and the same entity with regard to the confirmation of the arbitration provision, the arbitration confirmation judgment. So they were basically just saying, look, they're all the same. They didn't assert a new direct cause of action against LP, did they?
Factually, Your Honor, I would disagree with you. That was their legal theory. It was misnomer. But was it factually asserted, the merger, the assumption? It was factually asserted. The Dallas Court of Appeals addressed it on the last page of their opinion.
Well, did LP ever become an actual party? Because they're not in the appeal.
They did not. They did not. And that was the...
So LLC was making the argument, and LLC had the same officers as LP, and the control was the same, LP or LCC, LLC. I can't get it right. But LP never actually became a party to that lawsuit with regard to the substitution argument.
That is correct. PGB was invited to substitute and amend their pleadings, ask for the judgment to be vacated so that they could go back to the arbitrator and correct the party issue. They chose not to do it. At a time when they contended the trial judge retained plenary power to vacate that judgment so that it could go back to the arbitrator, reopen evidence, amend pleadings to add a new party, because these were determined to be different parties. It was a party defect in the original suit, but the merger and the assumption and the knowledge, the actual knowledge of all of that, including the other party, Ancor LP, they knew about it.
Is it your position that the judgment against the LLC is an invalid judgment, not subject to execution in any way?
Well, I don't believe it's an invalid judgment.
Okay, so it's subject to execution because it's a valid judgment from a Texas district court that's gone to finality through the Dallas Court of Appeals. So why is it not a judgment debt that can then be asserted as a third-party beneficiary claim on the merger contract?
Well, I think to enforce a judgment, you can enforce a judgment against a judgment debtor named in the judgment.
Well, if this had been, for example, an indemnity provision in the merger as opposed to an assumption, then you could enforce the indemnity provision as a third-party beneficiary of the contract once you obtain the judgment against LLC, because LLC had a right under the merger contract to the assumption of its debt, did it not?
I'm sorry, Justice Burbaugh.
Let me ask it again. Once under the merger contract,
yes,
between LLC and LP,
yes, sir,
LLC had a contractual right that it could assert against LP for the assumption of debts, so that LLC would never have to pay another debt once the merger occurred and it ceased to exist.
That may be true.
Okay, that's a contractual obligation that LP undertook. So once Peterson obtains a judgment and becomes a judgment creditor of LLC, and therefore it becomes a judgment debt under the law, why is not Peterson, a third-party beneficiary, entitled to assert the contractual right of the LLC for assumption of the debt?
Your Honor, I don't know that claim has ever been asserted.
Okay, that's why I asked him about the pleadings, and that's what I need to know.
And Your Honor, I would say I don't know that claim has ever been asserted. It doesn't matter what you label a cause of action for res judicata. It matters by the bar versus resolution trust case, the Supreme Court case in 1996, I believe it was 96, that they cite is the standard on res judicata. It's what are the transactions? What are the events? It doesn't matter what you label the cause of action. And the reason I say that, because it goes to Justice Sutter's question of, didn't you attempt to litigate the merger issue? You asked that of PGV. Didn't you attempt to litigate the merger issue? Because I think, Justice Sutter, you asked, isn't the merger issue different from, or the understand the guarantee issue, but isn't the assumption issue another issue? But didn't you also attempt to litigate the assumption issue? They positively did. And it's noted on the last page of the opinion of the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion. But what I would say about it is, the assumption issue is—that's what they call their—they call their claim in this second lawsuit an assumption cause of action. It is the same as the merger claim. The assumption arises and derives from the merger document, the merger agreement. The merger agreement was a matter of public record. That was a transaction that occurred 4 years before PGV filed the original Dallas lawsuit. And it goes straight to the bar test. And what I would call the court's attention to, I think there's a good discussion in the CONCAC versus Deutsche Bank case that we cite in our brief. It cites to the bar case, and it says that one of the factors as to whether two cases, a first case, a prior case, and a subsequent case, are related enough in causes of action or could have or should have been raised, one of the factors is whether the facts are related in time, space, and origin. These are: the assumption claim, the merger claim, is absolutely related in time, space, and origin because it predated the first action. It was already there. And it's a basis, that same matter that occurred in September of 2000, 4 years before they filed the Dallas suit, is the same basis for this second lawsuit.
Well, LLC wouldn't have had a basis for seeking assumption under the merger contract until it became a judgment debtor, would it not? Because there wasn't a judgment against it. There wasn't a judgment against it, so they would not have had a basis for seeking assumption under the merger contract against LP until they actually became a judgment debtor. So in what manner is LLC's contractual claim against LP, has that actually been adjudicated for res judicata purposes in the underlying claim where Peterson is simply attempting to say they're one and the same and asserting a direct action thereby against LP on the guarantee, not on the merger contract?
Your Honor, that hypothetical is tough for me to answer because PGV's never framed it in that sense. But I think that question focuses on defenses as opposed to res judicata. Is the focus on res judicata is, were the claims brought or should they have been brought? And to answer you, I'm trying my best to answer your question, and I want to offer this because I think it is within the briefing by both sides, is PGV did not have to wait to obtain a judgment against LLC in order to pursue liability against LP if that's the direction it always wanted to go or if it ever wanted to go, because a successor liability claim, which is an assumption of liability claim, runs coterminous with the underlying claim. And we briefed that. And if it runs coterminous, then it is ripe at the same time. And the reason it is here is this assumption that they allege had already occurred 4 years before this judgment.
Yeah, and counsel, I'm looking at the last page of the Dallas opinion that you referred us to, and maybe you can explain. I mean, it's unclear from the wording that they used exactly what they had before them, but I'm looking at this sentence under the section modification of appellant's name. PGV believed Anchor Holdings LP was the surviving entity of the merger and assumed Anchor's liabilities. Is that what you're talking about when you say that PGV was had essentially raised this idea of assumption of liabilities?
That's correct.
Way back when?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is it. When they reference an assumption of liability and they reference a merger, and they did, there was only one. They are referring to the same transaction that is referred to in PGV's live pleading in this underlying lawsuit. Your Honors, the issue of res judicata is the defense that prevailed at the trial court. Three elements, we think they were positively met here. PGV has argued law of the case, and I want to touch on that in just a moment. But res judicata, the first element, judgment, valid judgment, nobody disputes that. Nobody is challenging that. Whether the claims either were or should have been brought, I addressed that effectively through the questions that I touched on. The same parties or parties in privity with them, Your Honors, that is an issue that when the case was remanded back from the El Paso court, that issue was reversed, but it was remanded. And when it was remanded, further proceedings were initiated. Among those were two significant depositions. And from those depositions, a set of privity facts, in our opinion, a set of privity facts, very core fundamental privity facts, were developed and taken and placed into the record. And those additional privity facts is what the trial judge considered when he considered the cross motion that PGV has appealed, the judgment from the cross motion that PGV is appealing.
Did not that evidence, though, simply support the successor liability, the successor and interest argument that you originally made that was, in fact, rejected by the El Paso Court of Appeals, saying that the evidence in the record, which included the merger agreement, okay, did not establish as a matter of law a successor and interest defense under the circumstances?
Your Honor,
it didn't. You're saying successor and interest was established privity, but the Court of Appeals in El Paso said, well, we've got on this record, it doesn't establish res judicata.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with the interpretation of the opinion or the statements in the opinion. I think, respectfully, I think when they addressed res judicata, they addressed one element. They bypassed the same claims element. They said, well, that's not the end of the story. You got to show privity, and these appellees didn't even address privity. Your Honors, we did. We felt like we did, and with all due respect to the El Paso court, we just think they got it wrong. One thing we noted, and we briefed this to this court, PGV had admitted privity. It was, all parties went into that appeal thinking privity was undisputed. The El Paso court felt differently, but what they did is they reversed on res judicata and essentially said, as a matter of law, this record before us doesn't establish res judicata. They remanded that issue. And when it was remanded, the evidence was reopened on that issue. There was no further limiting instruction back to the trial court. And further proceedings were initiated, in fact, by PGV. Two significant depositions, and the additional evidence that went into the record came from those depositions, but it went to the issue of privity, the connection and shared interest among these defendants with the defendant in the original lawsuit. It's not a shared identity. That was the misidentification misnomer issue. But it is a shared commonality of interest that establishes privity. And those facts that are before this court and that were before our trial court are different. They are more robust on the issue of privity, without a doubt. And in our opinion, absolutely establishes privity as a matter of law. Those facts were not before the El Paso court. Justice Burwell, the court can obviously read the opinion in the event I am misquoting or misciting it, but I do not believe they said, as a matter of law, successor liability cannot be established. In fact, I think they just...
No, you're right. They didn't say that. They did say this record doesn't establish.
Yes, sir. And that's precisely my point today, is that opinion, the trial court didn't rule on limitations. They weren't asked to. The trial court, upon remand, addressed res judicata again with a different record. And they were allowed to do that. Law of the case does not bar that because the opinion and the mandate from the El Paso court does not limit the reopening of the record with respect to that issue. It simply does not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I may jump around here probably just a little bit. With respect to the allegation that PGV had actual knowledge of the murder, I think that's belied by the Eighth Court's holding, which found that Keenan McGibbon, who were the two main principals of both of these Ancor entities, testified under oath that, in essence, Ancor LLC was a going entity. That's what the Eighth Court found. I don't know how we could have actual knowledge when they spent 3.5 years litigating basically on behalf of Ancor LLC. Again, with respect to the constructive notice of the merger, we discussed it earlier. Under the terms of the guarantee, the merger without BOA's permission was prohibited. I don't know of a case where a constructive notice has been used in a situation like this, where a bank actually has a duty to go out and search public records to make sure that its guarantors aren't breaching its guarantee agreements, especially when that guarantee agreement, again, is litigated for a course of 3.5 years with nobody raising the issue.
But when you file your original lawsuit and you're looking at the Secretary of State's information for purposes of service of the lawsuit, don't you find it there?
One would think you may. I can't answer that question, Your Honor. We weren't involved at that time. I will tell you that they didn't, for whatever reason.
Because you got to figure out who you got to serve, whether it's the right entity that you're serving. So wouldn't that you actually be in that data, mucking around in there to figure out who to serve for what corporation?
I can't dispute the fact that one would think that would be the case, but again, having not been involved, I don't know how we got to where we got. All I know is we're here. The fact is, there, again, but for the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion, I would think we would argue it's the same entity. After that merger, there is only one entity, but that's not where we are. Where we are is they're separate and distinct entities, and if they're separate and distinct entities, the only one that could have been sued on the breach of the guarantee is LLC. They were the only one that executed the guarantee.
How are we to make the distinction that you appear to want us to make, okay, which is that there's a distinction between obtaining a direct liability judgment against LP and then trying to obtain an assumption of the judgment liability against LP in this particular one, particularly as Justice Kerr pointed out, that the argument that's identified in the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion is not simply an argument that there was a merger, but also an argument of an assumption of liability under the circumstances. And so how are we to find that the assumption of liability was not, in fact, litigated in Dallas, and therefore is being raised a second time?
I think the transaction that we're looking at, though, is the 3.5 year arbitration, which it wasn't raised. That by the time it was found out, we're now sitting at post judgments where all you can really do is move to modify it, and it was moved on a misnomer ground because there was only one entity. And again, with the court holding that they're two separate entities, the liability of LP is solely on that assumption, and it was not litigated in the first case. The first case was strictly, are you liable under the guarantee?
But should it have been litigated? Now that you're on notice, you've got plenary power of the court, should it be litigated?
After 3.5 years of arbitration, I don't even know if you could send it back after that. I mean, and I certainly don't know of a case that says you would have to. Could you theoretically have sued both on the front end, even if you knew that they were separate entities? Maybe, but I don't think the claim itself, until there is a judgment, there's no liquidated amount to collect under the assumption. There's nothing for LP to pay. So you have to litigate the breach of the LLC first.
Right, but once you started talking about them being one and the same entity, then shouldn't you have brought all your theories?
Which would essentially be a misnomer theory that was shot down by the court, which found that
it would have also been an assumption theory as well at that time, wouldn't it? I mean, the Dallas court certainly seemed to think that was in play in some fashion.
Not having been involved in the appeal, I can't tell you exactly what was briefed, but there wasn't the assumption under that merger agreement was not briefed in the arbitration. It wasn't a part of that case. Could it have been a part of that case? for the purposes of res judicata, meaning was it compulsory? I would tell you no, it's not compulsory. Could it have been? You know, perhaps. With that, Your Honors, we would respectfully request the judgment be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful. You're free now to, your case has been submitted. You're free to leave if you desire, or you can stay and listen to the next one. It's up to you. Thank you very much.